Welcome to The Lover's Hole, a Patrick O'Brien podcast. You're with Mike.
And Ian.
And we are typically rereading the Aubrey Matron books of Patrick O'Brien. But this week, we've got a special episode. A few weeks ago, The Lover's Hole had the opportunity to visit the British National Maritime Museum in Greenwich. Certainly an important location in Jack Aubrey's life as an important naval base, as the home of the Astronomer Royal, and hence the measurement of longitude. So, you know, getting our heroes home counted on this important fact. So this is now the home of one of the UK's top sources for naval and maritime history, the Caird Library and Archive. Sadly, I couldn't make it over there for just a day. We're still trying to work with our Star Trek friends to get that teleportation device up and running here. But Ian and Sam, our editor, you know, talked to the team at the museum, got a chance to look over some great documents and sources that underpin the O'Brien canon. So the entire visit was captured in video and audio. And if you're listening to this right now, why don't you pause and head over to YouTube to enjoy the experience in all its technicolor glory here. So let's pick it up with Ian, who made the journey down from Cambridgeshire down to southeast London a few weeks ago.
So we're here today in Greenwich. I'm outside the National Maritime Museum, and we're going to take the Lover's Hole indoors on a little bit of a history trail. We're going to visit the Caird Library and Archive. We're going to talk to curator Jeremy Mitchell, and we're going to look at some documents and artifacts that are going to link us back to the stories of the Patrick O'Brien books. Let's go inside and take a look. So welcome. We're sitting here in the Caird Library at the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich. We're going to spend some time today talking about the things that we can learn here in the Library and Archive about the historical events that underpinned what we read about in the Aubrey Matron novels. And I'm very excited to be working today with Jeremy Mitchell, who's a curator here at the museum. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you.
So tell us a bit about yourself. How do you come to be a curator at the National Maritime Museum? And tell us a bit about how that links to your reading of the O'Brien books as well.
Well, I've been here 20 years. I didn't mean to join the museum. It just came up as a job advert, having done a master's in maritime history. And it's like, oh, I'll apply. And here I am still. So now I'm one of the senior curators, and I'm responsible for the photographic collection, the ship's plans collection, the curator responsible for ship models, the curator's responsible for the Cutty Sark. So it's quite a big mix of collections.
Tell us a bit about the Caird Library. I guess it's a name and institution that not many people have heard of on the tourist trail visiting museums around London. How does it fit into the museum and what's its job?
Yeah, the Caird Library is named after our first major benefactor. He effectively bankrolled the existence of the museum in the early 1930s. And James Caird was a good friend of our first director, Geoffrey Callender. So it was named after him. And he purchased a lot of what ended up coming here in terms of prints and drawings, library books, the archive. So it's not just a pure library, it also has archival records. And unlike somewhere like the National Archives, these tend to be much more personal collections from merchant marine, from the Royal Navy, from yachts and yachtsmen. But equally, it does also hold some official records from the Navy Board, whether duplicated copies, we might have some here, or even our own unique ones.
Okay. So the National Archive, if I've got that right, that's things like service records, but there are things here that are kind of some of the working documents from...
That's right, yeah. Okay. Yeah, the National Archives is like the sort of corporate knowledge of Great Britain. It's where all the official records go. And there was a time when some of those official records came to here. Yeah. So we're the national repository for the ship plans collection that were generated by the Admiralty over the last 300 years.
Wow. Okay. All the way back then, including the Napoleonic times and including some of our favourites.
Yeah.
Wow. Fantastic. We're talking about the Patrick O'Brien books, or at least the connections to them that we can find today. Tell us about your history reading O'Brien, and what's it like as somebody knowledgeable about the subject reading fiction on the matter?
Well, I have a bit of a confession to start with, that I was brought up on The Hornblower. And when I did start to read O'Brien, I didn't quite get into it. I think I started a bit young. But during a job interview for our departmental administrator, I'd asked her, what got you into maritime history? And she said the Patrick O'Brien books. And I thought, probably about time I properly sat down to read them. So I'm now on book 11 of 21. So I'm getting there.
Oh, fantastic. Got any favourite moments so far?
Have I got any favourite moments? Yeah, somewhere it's he goes to parts of the world where there are lesser known stories, like the capture of the islands in the Indian Ocean. Yeah. And those sort of things that actually aren't part of my area of knowledge. And it's like, oh, I'll go and read a bit more about that. So I tend to see any historical fiction as a good thing because it gets people into the actual history because they're that interested. They'll go and have a look and find out more about it. And then you can see also where fiction writers take historical figures and move them out the way for their character to take over. Which I find a really interesting way of having a vehicle for the narrative.
It's fascinating. I've got a theory that maybe Hornblower and Jack Aubrey might have met in the action to capture the Spanish treasure frigates, the Medea and the Medusa. They were both at the same action, apparently, according to Forrester and O'Brien together.
Is that right?
It seems like the British people have got a particularly strong fascination with naval history and with naval history of this era. And we spoke a little while ago to a French naval history scholar specializing in this era, and he said he was one of a handful, and he didn't have resources like we have sitting here today. Have you got any thoughts about what it is that makes the British so fascinated with this period and their naval history in particular?
I think it's partly about how history is being taught in Britain, especially if you look at how the Navy projects itself. It's predominantly a Nelson-focused narrative.
Yeah.
And people will know something about Nelson. They'll also, as people go into their own family history, realise how closely connected so many families are with the Navy. You then get films that come out, even all the way back in the 50s, you've got Damn the Defiant and other sort of films that start to heroise some of the characters that are fictional and real. And even with Patrick O'Brien, with the Master and Commander, which is a synthesis of a lot of different people and different events out of different books to create that narrative. It's actually a very good film. And then ITV did the Hornblower series. Yeah. Yeah, so you get this sort of projection all the time being pushed through. And the historical fiction goes all the way back to Mr. Midshipman Easy and the Marriott stories he had served with Cochrane.
Yeah.
He was there at the death of Napoleon. We've got the sketches of Napoleon's death mask in the collection and Marriott was the man who was there for that.
Fascinating. So we've got all these personal connections, we've got family connections, we've got resources as well. Tell us a bit about what kind of resources we've got here in the collection.
Well, the collections here are huge. There's over 100,000 books in the library. I'm responsible for nearly a million ship plans, of which I'd say probably just under a third are the Admiralty collection, which will include the ships that O'Brien based his stories on, like Surprise and Sophie and Leopard. Yeah. So the resources here are huge, and we do have a process of digitizing. So the 18th century ship plans have all been digitized and are all sort of mostly accessible online. I haven't finished cataloging all 8,000 of them yet, but I'm getting there. We have all of this sort of knowledge that just resides here that people dip in and out of and researchers will use. And it's not just naval historians or maritime historians, that you'll get social historians as well using the collections to understand how people lived and thought within the maritime environment.
Right. And I guess you talked earlier on about how the National Archives is the corporate memory. You're kind of telling us a little bit that this is more like the social and personal memory of people going to sea and serving at sea.
Yes. And a lot of the sort of the nationals are there to reflect what society was doing, which might actually not quite chime with what the official records are recording. And having those personal voices within the archives here just helps to flesh out what might otherwise just be a rather dry and laboriously written, this is what we want Captain so-and-so to do. Meanwhile, you've got his letterbox, which will be of correspondence back to the Admiralty or to other captains or senior officers, which might give you a bit more of an insight into how he experienced life at sea at the time.
Oh, very good. We might come across some examples of this when we go look at some items in a moment. We've read that O'Brien spent time consulting primary sources, like and including the National Archives, and I guess also Greenwich. Are there any folk tales around here of whether he ever visited or what he was like to be with?
Not that I'm aware of, though. There is the story of a biography of Hornblower that cites the archive is held here, and of course it's all fiction. So there are people who do turn up and ask whether we hold the Hornblower archive and could they look at it. So the poor library and archive team have to sort of let them down gently on that.
Presumably they just point them to a shelf with an omnibus edition of Hornblower and say...
Pretty much, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Are the O'Brien books on a shelf somewhere here in this building?
Do you know, I have absolutely no idea. I'm assuming they are somewhere.
Speaking of personal history, let's take a couple of minutes to go and look at some of the items that you've managed to unearth for us here, and we'll talk about what we can learn from them. So, Jeremy, here we are looking at some examples of items that the library staff here kindly dug out for us, connected to some of the incidents and some of the people that we know about in the books here. First of all, right here, we've got this. This, I think, is the warrant, or this is a duplicate of the warrant signed by Lord Keith appointing James Guthrie as surgeon aboard the sloop Speedy. And of course, O'Brien fanatics all know, I guess, that Speedy was the origin of the Sophie. And in this role, at any rate, James Guthrie was the origin for part of the character of Stephen Maturin. So tell us, what's the significance of a warrant like this? How does it come to be? Why might it still be in the possession of Guthrie in his personal papers?
Well, Guthrie at this time was a surgeon's first mate, so he hadn't actually made the rank of surgeon. But the predecessor on Speedy had been promoted into another ship. Okay. So Guthrie is then promoted into Speedy, but to provide the paperwork, Lord Keith has had to give him a warrant. So he's a warrant officer as a surgeon, not a commissioned officer, because a commission comes from the Admiralty, courtesy of the Crown, whereas a warrant officer, it's given from the Admiralty as a warrant position, i.e. you have that piece of paper that says, so that's the context to it. And the fact it's a duplicate means that it would be useful for Guthrie to have it because it's evidence of him both being promoted but also for his pay.
Wow, okay. So it's an important document for him personally, as well as a record of what was going on in service. Dated 1800, so it's fascinating. This is before the Battle of Algeciras, before Trafalgar, before so many of the events were taking place in the Mediterranean, with all of this still to come. Fascinating. I noticed two different handwriting sets here. We've got the very regular kind of copper plate filled in with some of the specifics with what looks more like kind of regular everyday copper plate. Is this a printed document?
I don't think it is. It looks as though it is, but I think it's been written neatly by one of Keith's clerks. Mm-hmm. And then... Because it's a pro forma, they then added what they need to make it very specific to Guthrie's promotion.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. So we've got a few more things from the Guthrie collection to come to, but first of all, I want to just dwell on this moment of the fictional Stephen Maturin being appointed a surgeon and think about what he might have got together to get ready. So let's take a look at something else. Okay, so now here we have a copy of a book that was important for Stephen Maturin. One of the early chapters of Master and Commander, he's being persuaded, not gently and not so gently, by Jack Aubrey to sign on as a warrant holding surgeon aboard Sophie. And he says to himself at some point that, well, maybe it wouldn't be so bad as a surgeon. All he'll need is a couple of instruments and some supplies. And he says in the text, a copy of Northcote's Marine Practice, and then he'll be all set. And here we have a copy of Northcote's book entitled The Marine Practice of Physic and Surgery, including that in Hot Countries by William Northcote, Surgeon. So there's a particular couple of things in here that I'd like to take a look at, but tell us a bit about where the book might have come from or why it might be important, particularly for somebody in Stephen Maturin's role as a surgeon.
Well, the first thing is that Northcote, as he advertises in the book, is a surgeon many years in His Majesty's service. So this book is written from the point of view of a practical man who has been at sea, so he will be aware
of the work that a surgeon will need to do on board a ship, and also the conditions of you know, said amputations or whatever it might be. So that's why it's an interesting book. So any surgeon who's going to take this book will know that it's not written by someone who's never been to sea. There is a practical element to it. But also looking at the date of this is written 30 years before he goes. So even 30 years later, this book is still being seen as something of relevance to them.
Yeah, so an authority. So it might not be a surprise that it came rapidly to his mind.
That's right, yeah.
It's fascinating. I wonder slightly about the stains on the pages here. I don't want to dwell too long on it. It's also noticeable as you flip through the list of procedures, there's a lot of male, how can I put this delicately, there's quite a lot of male-oriented surgical and medical knowledge in here. One or two special call-outs for things to do with the female anatomy. There are things in here, of course, about cutting for kidney stones and bladder stones. There are things in here about amputation. I was particularly struck by the passage on trepanning, familiar to everybody who's seen the movie and read Master and Commander. He gives detailed instructions of the instruments that you'll need and the swabs and the pledgets that you need before you sit down with your trephine. I don't think he mentions the Lavoisier trephine in particular, but he's clearly talking about the same thing. I love the slightly ghoulish instructions for what happens when you're almost done with the trepanning. He says, talking about the segment of bone that you've cut out of the skull, being quite sawed through, it will sometimes come out in the crown of the trephine, but if it does not, it must be taken out with the forceps, and if the lower edges of the bone are splintered, they may be smoothed with the lenticular, which is enough to give you the shivers. It says, in this operation, there is little or no pain, yet expedition is much recommended. And I think if I was the patient, I'd be very happy for them to get it over with in a hurry.
Yeah, I like the way it's portrayed as a public operation as well.
Yeah.
On more than one occasion, you have the crew who have this morbid delight of watching other people under sufferance, but actually would probably hate having it done to themselves.
Absolutely. And I suppose it's a very, very thin, slender little bit of hope and reassurance that the doctor's read about it in the book before he opens you up.
That's right. But it's an operation that lives with him all through. It's continually mentioned that he righted his brains or something along those lines.
Yes, before the tide was turned or something.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So there we have Northcote's Marine Practice. I'd like to take a little bit of look at the life and times of Cochrane, if that's okay. So let's have a look at a few Cochrane-related things that we have here. So, Jeremy, there's a huge stack of correspondence here from Guthrie's personal papers. This was clearly a bequest to the library quite some time ago. And of course, Guthrie having this close personal relationship with Cochrane, that means that we get some great Cochrane material here. I found three letters that were really, really interesting for different stages of Cochrane's life. This particular one addressed to Guthrie from Cochrane as early as 1809. He's already on friendly terms. And dear Guthrie, that's clearly an address to a friend. And this is a letter written from London talking about Cochrane's hoped for continued service career. He talks about his hopes of being appointed to a commander of the Rochefort station. So he's in his frigate captain blockade duty time. He also talks a little bit about a review of the court-martial of Admiral Gambier, talking about inevitable damnation. And I guess that must have been in connection with the action at Basque Roads. Does that make sense?
It does. Cochrane, being the eccentric that he was, also a little bit like Nelson, a self-publicist, didn't suffer fools gladly if they didn't agree with him. He was very good at what he did because he had that frigate captain's mentality, which I think other captains like Pellew also had, which is understanding the importance of the ship they have and how you can use it. And of course, Jack Aubrey is precisely identified as that kind of captain who knows how to use his ship to the best advantage. And if he doesn't, there's usually some extraordinary reason why he's now having to chuck cannon and everything over the side to avoid capture. But Cochrane is very much of that belief, but also like Aubrey, he's a bit old school. So the idea of having a vicar or preacher on board, he dislikes in the same way. And of course, Gambier is part of the Blue Stocking Brigade of new evangelicals on board these ships.
Yeah, so clearly not a person to be on easy, good terms with Cochrane, in addition to whatever went on with the leadership of the Basque Roads Supply Ship Expedition.
That's right, yes.
Yes. So, fascinating. Let's turn a few pages to later in Cochrane's life. This one dated 1815, we think. is a letter dated King's Bench. And if I'm not much mistaken, this is Cochrane writing to his friend Guthrie immediately in the aftermath of the Stock Exchange trial. And he talks a little bit about the judgment of that villain, Ellenborough. This is a scenario that we're all familiar with as the tragic part of the Aubrey arc when he's been convicted following the Stock Exchange fraud, which of course was an episode from Cochrane's own life.
That's right. And Cochrane, of course, again, being that eccentric, doesn't just sort of take it lying down. He goes off and becomes a mercenary. And so the stories that then come out about how he's able to sort of assist the independence of the South American countries is really incredible, and of course gets reflected in the books and the personalities that come through.
Now, where we are in the arc of the stories at the moment, the surprise as a hired vessel has been meant to be headed for South America for at least 2.5 books now, hasn't quite got there, but without too many spoilers for you, I hope, Jeremy, there's a letter here from Cochrane to Guthrie writing home, date marked Valdivia frigate off Callao in Peru, I think that is. Dated 1821. So by this time, Cochrane's in that mercenary stage of his life.
Yes, though of course in reality, supplies had been broken up by then in its real history.
Yeah.
But because obviously O'Brien has an affection for this very small and actually slightly redundant frigate, that he perpetuates that story and that. And really actually, if you forget the actual history, you see a sort of relationship going on between a ship that is meant to be an inanimate object, but quite clearly isn't, for the crew and for Aubrey. And it's that kind of relationship that O'Brien is really pulling out. And I think that it's important for people when they read these books or even just read about history that the ships were never inanimate. They were part of that. They were part of the crew, as it were. They kept you safe. They were your home from home. And of course, being on a foreign station where you don't have the same infrastructure that he would have done if he'd been in the regular Navy takes on a very different dynamic of how you nurture this ship through, you know, what could be, you know, fighting battles against the Portuguese or the Spanish or whoever in order to allow countries to gain their independence.
Yeah, and he was clearly politically and personally very heavily invested in the cause as well.
That's right.
There's a little bit of investment hint, I think, for Guthrie at the end of the letter. If I read it right, he talks about looking forward to the moment when he can grant Guthrie 1,000 acres of good land on my estate. So I hope that's not a spoiler for anybody, but Cochrane's feeling pretty good about the future. The other thing I liked about this document as well is that we can see the remains of the seal and we can see how it's addressed as well. So for a document written off the coast of South America, it says Dr. James Guthrie, Abernathy, Scotland. The guy's never heard of a postcode.
No, as long as he's gone back on the packet ship to England, that it will find its way up through to Scotland.
Fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for talking us through. Really interesting to see some of these real things connected to Cochrane. There are a couple of things that I want to just touch on that talk about other bits of the real life exploits of the books in the canon. So let's see what we've got.
Okay.
So, Jeremy, here we've got a document from another part of the canon. In the Mauritius Command, remember that Jack Aubrey, as a temporary commodore, encounters this rather particular, rather charismatic individual, Lord Clonfert. Interesting but doomed character, as it turns out. We believe that Lord Clonfert's character was partly based on the conduct of a captain named Willoughby, who was in command of the Tribune for a while. And what we've got here is Willoughby's general order book from his time in command of the Tribune. So tell us a little bit about an order book and how it's different from any of the other documents and service records that we might come across.
Yeah, the general order book from the captain is his view of how he expects his officers to conduct themselves. And it will also illustrate very particular interests that captain may have about dress or signalling or when boats are launched or whatever it might be. So you get an insight into how the captain thinks his ship should be run, but also possibly a reflection of what he thinks his officers might be like. And I suspect to some extent it could well be written to the lowest common denominator, even though your more senior officers, you know, may have been at sea for years. if you've got midshipmen and boys on board who are aspiring midshipmen, then at least they've got something to refer to, which is very different from a logbook or a muster book, which is an official document that has to go back to the Admiralty, which allows pay to be received or officers' conduct to be checked.
Okay, so this is the captain making his kind of personal prescription for how he wants his officers to behave. Like you say, he has a fairly low opinion of what the lowest common denominator might be. On page 3, we have him giving them the basic rules of the road. The vessel with the wind on the starboard tack shall have the wind of the vessel on the larboard tack. This is the basic rules of the road, which is really, really kind of 101 level stuff. He's got prescriptions in there about how officers should behave, leaving the deck and getting permission from the officer of the watch. And if we look at this all together, there are many, many pages of quite closely written text. I can imagine this guy was perhaps not always the easiest to work with.
No, I think you're probably right, especially as I think he goes up to at least 90 something, doesn't it, by the end of it. Yes, you've got, it goes up to at least 104 orders in there. So you'd be expected to, if not remember all of them, certainly get the gist of most of them and hope you've abided by them.
Yeah, well, tough times for the master's mates. Never.
That's right.
Fantastic. Let's see what else we can find. So, final item for us to look at here, Jeremy, is a letter. We've got the original, this very, very precious, very finely written, very fragile original, and to help us all, typescript as well, of a letter written home by the carpenter of HMS Alceste. And the Alceste was the ship on Far East service carrying an envoy that got shipwrecked and then found itself in battle with local Dayak warriors in a series of events that is very clearly the pattern for what happened to the Diane in the closing chapters of 13 Gun Salute and also at the very beginning of Nutmeg of Consolation. This looks like a very educated young man for a carpenter. This is very, very neatly written and very, very carefully written out. What do you think?
It is. I think people just make assumptions that the more practical warrant officers on board might be illiterate, but actually a lot of the time they wouldn't be. They would have had some form of education and training before they then went on board a ship. And sometimes you would find that the training might happen on board the ship. So if you've got an educated man like a surgeon or even the local sort of vicar who's on board, then they may be training people and teaching them to read and write. But actually this handwriting looks very confident. So I suspect he learned from a young age. Mm.
He's got a lot to say in the text about his carpentry trade, about the care and restoration of barrels and wrecked shipping materials. He's clearly a good carpenter. He's also got an eye for the detail of the battle. And I really liked, we had some Stephen Maturin character connections earlier on. We've got a Jack Aubrey character connection. About three quarters of the way through the description, this young carpenter describes the moment, I think, of the second attack of the Dayak warriors. He says, as they saw the enemy arriving, our captain beat to arms. He called all hands together and made his speech to the people and related that we were surrounded with a number of enemies. He felt himself quite confident of gaining victory over them, and we would either conquer or die, for it was certain they would put us all to death, and that we must keep all under arms tonight, and that there will be a fresh allowance of grog. And the paragraph finishes off with him saying that they rendered three hearty cheers.
Right. So, it's all about the heroism, isn't it? And that's, I think, why the period becomes quite an attractive one for writers as well as readers, because you read about improbable situations that actually are real, and you don't really need to make a huge amount of it up. But again, for a carpenter on that voyage, you know, he's able to write home about it. Because it is, you know, quite a unique experience for him to be so far away from home, probably for a very long time. Yeah. And it's almost like a relief from the monotony of having to write to or keep records of the barrels he's had to break down or break up or have been lost over the side and justify the expenses and all of that sort of thing. So to have something that's a much more personal narrative is a really nice insight from a different warrant officer.
Yeah, fantastic. And it's a good example, as you were saying, of the kind of artifact that finds its way here rather than into service records. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Jeremy, thank you very much. It's been lots and lots of fun to look at these things and talk them through, and thank you for providing the context.
Not at all. Yeah. Thank you.
We spent some time looking at these the items from the archive here. As you say, they're quite personal, they're quite social. a couple of our listeners are interested in whether there might be anything in the collections here that was either declassified from an intelligence source or has a connection to the world of Stephen Matcher and intelligence. Is there anything on the shelves here in a yellow cover, as you might say?
I don't think so. I suspect a lot of that will reside in the National Archives if it was official correspondence.
Okay.
Though, of course, we know that Blaine's character is based on Sir Joseph Banks to some extent, but also others who were involved with the intelligence networks. And officers were encouraged to send information back, and the sketches they did would allow a picture to be built up back in the Admiralty of what's going on out there and help them make decisions. But ultimately, on the ground, and this comes through in a number of the books, that the intelligence networks become very specific to the admiral in charge of that particular area. So when he's in the Mediterranean, you've got Jarvis and others who have their own network. So while Maturin is like this sort of a government spy, he is also working within the local network of intelligence gathering. And so you've got admirals whose job is not just about commanding a fleet. It's actually being the diplomat on the ground and having to make decisions. We forget that communication is a lot longer in those days. There's a much more independence of command, and you sort of hope you get it right.
Yeah. Also, it sounds like lots of opportunities for things getting crossed over or confused or mixed up, which, of course, is what happens in some of the books.
That's right. And you look at, a letter can come from the Admiralty to the Admiral, but actually circumstances have moved on and it's now irrelevant. So the Admiral has now got to make a decision in order to try to either come out with a similar result that has been asked for or actually have to explain why that's just not going to happen.
Eesh. Okay. Tough times in intelligence in the early 19th century, goodness me. And of course, no, as you say, slow written communications, no telegraphy, no wireless, no. You mentioned that the resources that we've got here were part of the sort of bequests and collection set up by Caird in the beginning. I get the impression, though, that this isn't a completely static collection. What sorts of new acquisitions are going on? What kind of new things find their way into the archive and the library here?
Yeah, I think some of the most recent material we've acquired from a family, the Bedford family, who were naval officers, and Frederick Bedford was involved in lots of Victoria's wars in the mid to late 19th century. He accompanied the Prince of Wales to India, and we have his photograph albums, which we'd acquired some in the past, but we knew there were gaps in the sequence because they were so beautifully put together as a narrative. And now we've just acquired through the family, there's three branches have got together and said, actually, we think you should have the rest of these albums that we've got, plus all this correspondence from these other people in the family. So what that does is that gives us a real insight into how sort of naval families worked together and communicated, how they projected their experiences through things like albums, because he was a watercolorist as well as acquiring photographs. So part of that is held here, and part of it's held, the photographs are held with us in my team. And we've acquired, yacht design plans. So we don't just deal with the 18th and 19th century, deal with the 20th century. And it's the contemporary collecting that's the challenge now, is actually trying to identify areas that will be, of sort of national significance without knowing it's of national significance.
So you've got to kind of be led by your own nose and your own curiosity a little bit as well.
That's right. And also looking at how that material can speak back to the past so that you've got the contemporary relevance of things that have happened in the past.
And presumably you have to keep the world of research and scholarship updated with all of this as well. And, there are researchers sitting in the library right now working on stuff. Presumably there are people in the UK and even outside the UK who are looking out for what's coming in and whether they can incorporate it into their research.
That's right. One of the first things we do when stuff comes in is it gets sorted, it gets some kind of catalogue reference, and then it gets put on our online database so that people can find it. Or they may just email and say, I'm still researching this, have you got anything new?
Yeah.
And we can say yes or no. But we also are a research centre in our own right, so we have partnerships with other institutions to support PhD students. So in fact, some of our curators have gone through that process. I think about four of them are ex-PhD students that were joint partnerships with us and other universities. And that's really good because they're bringing a different knowledge to the institution. So those of us who are a little bit sort of maritime fanatic are being able to see the bigger picture by other people's expertise coming in.
And a bit of context always helps, right?
It does, yeah.
Fantastic.
I was really struck preparing for this visit, even beginning to think about this visit, when I learned that the library catalogue is online, members of the public can register as a reader for free and just come and browse the collection and access the materials here. That's fantastic. Do you get other people coming here on the trail of Marriott or Hornblower or O'Brien or any of the other fictional characters as well?
We do. And speaking from my experience with the Shipland collection, when Master and Commander came out, everyone wanted to make models of HMS Surprise.
Okay.
And we had the plans for Surprise and her sister ship that was also captured later on. Mm-hmm. And then both were incorporated into the Royal Navy. We have plans of Lively and Leopard. And so we get people who sort of want to reflect their interest in the books through a model, effectively. Though I do have to remind people that, and he does admit this himself, which is that he bends history to suit his own narrative.
Of course.
And you have to read that introduction to acknowledge that he is warning you that he is playing with history to suit his own ends.
Fantastic.
And as a historian or a person with a historical interest reading that, are you happy with where that ends up, or does it sometimes leave you a little bit uneasy? You know, if only he'd made that more accurately fall into that pattern there.
No, I think that so long as you've bought into your reading historical fiction and that the author has the right to manipulate history to fit their own agenda, then it's not a problem, because actually what will happen is that you will just go and look into it more and find actually, oh, it was this person who captured Diamond Rock rather than Belitho or whoever it might be.
Fascinating. So obviously priority one for you in the coming weeks and months is to finish your reading of the Aubrey Maturin canon. But meanwhile, tell us what you're up to here in your working life at the museum. What's coming up next for you?
Well, I'm also responsible for the Polar collection. So I've got to give a conference paper about the Polar collection in Canada next month.
Well, that's happens. Like, you wouldn't want to do the Polar collection in Brazil, really, would you? I mean,
no, it's an excellent opportunity to also meet up with curators out in Canada to talk to them about the collections that they have. Because again, similarly with the research being done behind the Napoleonic period, you can't really study the Napoleonic period without also talking to French researchers to find out what the French Navy was doing at the same time as the British Navy. And it's the same with the Polar collection. You can't talk about, you know, Franklin's 1845 expedition without talking to the Canadian researchers and to Inuit to understand that context as part of the bigger story.
Fantastic. Well, very good wishes with that. I'm very jealous of your trip to Canada. That sounds fantastic.
Thank you.
Jeremy, thank you very, very much for talking to us today. Thanks for joining us on The Lover's Hole, and we hope we see you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Ian, what a great day for you and Sam, and for all of us to have that chance to accompany you with the video and the audio here. We really appreciate it. You know, it's great to have such a wonderful source and resource open to the public, and to have such wonderful people to help you with that. You know, we often hear stories about how O'Brien did the research in his day and the wonderful folks that helped him. It looks like you and Sam certainly benefited from the kindness of strangers. Now, tell me, can folks just walk up to the door and do what you guys did today?
Well, Mike, almost. It's an amazingly open and easy access place, really. The whole principle of the archive is that it's there for the public. Members of the public can register online for free. And as long as you book in advance and book your visit, and as long as you respect the organization of the library, which is really mainly there as a place for scholars to do research, then you're fine. And I would say, if you're interested, just spend a little bit of time looking through the catalog online. Go to the National Maritime Museum website and just search and browse on a few terms. You'll be amazed how many familiar officers and ships' names come up when you do that.
Wow.
Exactly as you say, Mike, we were lucky to be treated so kindly and welcomed so warmly. We want to thank everybody at the National Maritime Museum who looked after us. Of course, Jeremy Mitchell, the senior curator, for giving us all his fascinating insights and his company. We want to say thank you to Naomi Atkinson and Ethan Bremerkamp from the museum's press team who made it all smoothly. And especially to Penny and the team at the Library and Archive who sourced the artifact for us, sourced those documents and helped us to make sure that we were handling them and taking care of them. thanks as well, this time more than ever, to our editor, Sam Luce, who was there on the day to make sure that we captured everything on sound and in video.
Well, so about a week ago, we finished up the nutmeg of Consolation. And when last we left our hearers, they were sailing away from Sydney with a bit of tension aboard the Surprise and a long list of unanswered questions. So, Ian, what do you say next week to just a little bit more Patrick O'Brien?
Mike, with all my heart. Thank you.